Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome to the Feel Good Podcast with Kimberly Snyder. Our goal is to help you develop a lifestyle that promotes health, wholeness, and healing. Feeling good is about accepting who we are and living from a place of inner peace in our perfectly imperfect lives. Every week, we provide you with interviews with top experts in their field to support you in living your most beautiful, inspired, and joyful life with a focus on health, wellness, meditation, and spirituality, and personal empowerment. I'm your host, Kimberly Snyder, founder of the lifestyle brand Saluna, New York Times best-selling author and nutritionist. Now let's get started. Hey, beauties, welcome back to our Monday interview podcast. I am so thrilled to have Jill Blakeway on with us today. She is an amazing woman that I met personally in New York City. We were on a panel together. She is a best-selling author. She has 3 books. Her 3rd book is coming out in April, all about energy healing. She's a licensed and board-certified acupuncturist and clinical herbalist, and she's the founder of Unova, which is an alternative health clinic in New York. She is super interesting. I was in the green room with her and I could not stop talking to this woman. She has so much wisdom. She has such beautiful energy and I can't wait to share her with all of us today, including myself. All the questions I got to ask her in the interview were ones I was dying to hear her perspective on. So you don't want to miss this interview. Before we dive in, I just want to give a shout out to our fan of the week, who is SW Venus or Southwest Venus. Love this name. And she writes, Kimberly's podcasts are more than just something I listen to occasionally. They have become part of my weekly ritual. The combination of passion and knowledge is unmatched, and her work, books, and supplements have truly enhanced my life. Thank you. Thank you so much, SW Venus, for being our fan of the week. I send you so much love and gratitude. I'm so happy you're in the community, and I am honored to be part of your life. So thank you so much. And beauties, if you have not yet left us a review on iTunes, and also for your chance to be the fan of the week, please just take 30 to 60 seconds out of your day and just pop on there. Leave us a review, which is a really wonderful way to spread the information and the light, the love of the podcast, which is our intention to help and reach as many as possible. So huge thank you in advance. You can also send a link of the podcast to friends, family members, colleagues, anyone else you think would benefit. And that would also be a wonderful way to spread the love. So that being said, let's dive right into our interview with the amazing Jill Blakeway. Hey, beauties, welcome back. I am so excited for our interview today. We have the fantastic Jill Blakeway, who is a best-selling author, a doctor of acupuncture and Chinese medicine, a clinical herbalist, and the founder of Unova, an alternative health clinic. So Jill, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you, Kimberly. It's lovely to be with you. Thank you for inviting me on your podcast.
Well, Jill, we met in New York. We were both on a panel for Well and Good, and I had so much fun talking to you about all the different work you're involved in. I mean, there's so many different things between your work with plants and alternative medicine and energy healing. I thought, oh my gosh, I have to have this lady on the podcast.
Well, I wear many different hats, Kimberly. Sometimes I confuse myself because I teach Chinese medicine and then I treat patients with acupuncture and Chinese herbs. And you're right, I also grow plants. And I did a podcast for CBS called Grow, Cook, Heal that was about all of that. And I write books. So I just keep swapping hats, which I think a lot of people do these days, don't they? That seems to be our lives.
It's true. It expands, you know, it just keeps growing. And I'm interested. Let's talk about that, first of all, about your perspective. You grow a lot of your own food. You grow a lot of plants. What would you say are some easy plants that the home gardener, the home grower should really focus on growing things that are easy that they can throw in their cooking, that are accessible to people. What are some of your top choices?
It all depends on how much space you have. Here in upstate New York, I'm lucky because I have quite a lot of space. And so my husband Noah and I, we grow everything. We grow onions and garlic and peas and beans and summer squash and lettuce and spinach and greens. And we're lucky to be able to do that. But for my team in New York at the Innova Center where I work in New York, I once planted kale plants in pots for them, because I realized they had a sort of kale chip habit that was really expensive, and that they could literally grow kale on their windowsill. So I bought kale seeds, and I planted kale seeds and grew them till they were little plants, and then brought them down for everyone so that they could rip off a few leaves and make kale chips as needed them, because, you know, to serve their kale chip habit. So it really depends. You know, if you have a windowsill, you can grow herbs, and fresh herbs are just beautiful cooked into your food and your salads and things like that. You can grow a kale plant on a windowsill. Mm-hmm. And if you can branch out, you can grow strawberries, for instance, in a pot. And if you have a little bit of room, I suggest starting with things that grow really easily, like chard and cucumbers and tomatoes. A tomato plant is like the easiest thing in the summer. They're very hardy, and they give you lovely fresh tomatoes all summer. And once you've picked your own tomato, you won't want to go back to supermarket ones, really, because a tomato straight off the vine is an amazing thing. So I'm quite a sort of evangelical about growing your own food.
So, Jill, I'm interested in hearing your perspective of tomatoes, or tomatoes, as you say, because I love them myself. I think they're amazing. I know that certain body types, you know, Ayurveda will say, oh, cooked tomatoes may be a lot of, you know, pitta. But then, you know, just in so many cultures, they've been an important food. And then lately, they've kind of become under attack for being a nightshade and being inflammatory, you know, for autoimmune conditions. But what do you think about tomatoes for people that don't have autoimmune conditions, or just in general, in your work, your perspective?
Well, I always tell my patients to see how they feel. You can tell how you feel after you eat something. There are people with arthritis who don't do well on nightshade vegetables, and that includes peppers and potatoes, as well as tomatoes or tomatoes, depending on where you come from. So it really, obviously, they're a great source of nutrients. They're a great source of antioxidants.
Yes.
And you're absolutely right. They're used in cultures around the world and have been for thousands of years for that reason. So I would say that if you have an inflammatory reaction to tomatoes, then you're going to have to move on to something else. But if you don't, if you feel fine on them, then I haven't seen people have trouble with them particularly. And I think we get a little scared of veggies in some ways, but most people, in my experience, tomatoes aren't the worst thing they're eating by a long way.
Thank you.
Most people do fine.
I completely agree. I think that there are certain, you know, headlines that grab attention, and people like to say, oh, now this is the scary thing about this food that you thought was really healthy. But like you said, Jill, in the grand scheme of, you know, what people are eating with all the processed foods and the sugars and things like that, tomatoes, like if you don't have, you know, an autoimmune condition, can actually be an amazing food for you. For me, I eat tomatoes all the time. I actually do grow them in my garden too, like you, Jill. I have heirloom. I have cherry tomatoes. Bubby, my son, my 2-year-old son, picks them off and eats them all day. So anyways, I'm glad that you share that perspective, because I think it's really individual and we shouldn't be scared by everything we hear.
I think so too.
So I love, you know, obviously because of your work with herbs and plants, you know, we share this love of how foods really affect the energy in our body and how we feel every day. And I'm really interested in your really intense work on energy healing in general. I know you are an acupuncturist, and you wrote a book recently, which may be out by the time some of you are listening to this. It's coming out April of 2019. So can you tell us, first of all, your perspective of energy healing and work and chi and Chinese medicine for those that are new to this whole thing? And then we could talk a little bit about your new book.
Absolutely. Well, energy is that animates us in some ways. But I also like to tell people it's your body's intelligence. It's the way your body's systems work together. It's the way your body knows how to restore homeostasis. So if you, say, drink a little bit too much alcohol, your liver knows, your liver has an intelligence to it. It knows to detoxify, you know, as long as you don't drink too much, and it knows to go into overdrive. Your body is intelligent, and that intelligence is really what the Chinese were referring to when they talked about qi and energy. And energy medicine refers to all those modalities that diagnose and treat illness by manipulating the energy that does pulse through every single cell in the body, which is measurable energy. And acupuncture is one of the oldest of those modalities. So in my new book, you're right, it comes out in April 2019. It's called Energy Medicine, The Science and Mystery of Healing, because I wanted to look at both the mystery of this very sort of ancient techniques all across the world of energy medicine, but also the newer science that is starting to be able to explain it. And recently, for example, Kimberly, there's been great strides in understanding why acupuncture works and why it has, in fact, stood the test of time and been practiced for thousands of years. And one of the things that researchers have found out, and this was research done at the University of Vermont Medical School, is that the acupuncture points themselves are quite specialized tissue. And when we give an acupuncture treatment, we pop the needle in. And I must say here, Kimberly, they're very tiny needles for people who haven't had acupuncture before. They're not, it's not like having a shot. It's very tiny, as you know. But once we pop those needles in, we twist them a little bit. And the connective tissue winds around the needle like spaghetti on a fork. And at the acupuncture points, it winds more. It turns out it has a greater grip, about 20% more of a grip. And it would appear that that stretching of the tissue creates like a little pathway that electrical energy can run through. And the reason it runs is that connective tissue is high in collagen, which is high in water. And water, as you know, is electroconductive. So acupuncture is a little electrical intervention that works on the connective tissue. And then it would appear that it the sensation is taken deeper into the body through the fascia. And if you put a map of the fascial planes up, it actually corresponds pretty much exactly to a map of the acupuncture meridians. So I don't think the ancient Chinese knew that the fascia was how this was being conducted necessarily. But surgeons are very familiar with the fascial planes. I interviewed a surgeon for my book that says that as a surgeon, he's very careful never to cut through these fascial planes if he can help it, because they keep the organs intact and they're very important to healing. And so it would appear that that little electrical sensation is taken through the fascia. And I think that's very interesting.
Well, can you explain for those who are new to fascia work, is that something that you incorporate at Unova, or is that some, because now fascia in LA, it's become like a kind of a popular thing, but is that something you would have to go to a separate expert, or is it sort of part and parcel with acupuncture, as you're saying, because it overlays in similar patterns?
Yes. I mean, we have we have craniosacral experts at Unova. We have a rolfing expert. Most people are actually working directly on the fascia, but it would appear that acupuncture is also transmitting its sensation through the fascia. And Chinese medicine, obviously, is its own system of medicine, but the two are very linked. And we find, for instance, that we often send our patients to our rolfer, who works sort of deeply on the fascia, and then that potentiates the acupuncture treatment when they come back to us, that freeing up the fascia is part of potentiating the treatment, which I think is really interesting.
Wow. What about, I know this is sort of, this may seem like a random question, Jill, but while you're talking about fascia and points, and I know you've done extensive research around the world for your book, what do you think about distance healing, energy healing? If there's someone that says, oh, I'm coming on the phone and I can feel things in your body and I can clear them from you know, long distance, states away or even another continent. Do you think there's any validity in that?
Well, it's interesting. I looked a little bit at distance healing for my book, and I was really looking for the science behind it, you know?
Yes.
And I saw some interesting research that shows that we are connected in ways we don't understand. At the University of Connecticut, for example, they put two people in separate MRIs in separate rooms. And when one thought about the other in a very sort of healing way, their brainwaves synced up, which I think is very interesting. That may actually be the feeling you have when you think about someone and then they call you, which happened to all of us. I don't know about you, but that happens to me the whole time, Kimberly.
I'll think about a patient
I haven't seen for years. Yep, all the time. And then they'll appear on my schedule the next week. So there, and at Princeton, they actually developed a machine that looked and measured the ways we connect in crowds. So I do think it's possible to affect each other. How much we affect each other from a distance, I'm not sure. And one of the things I also looked at in this book was charlatans and how to spot one. Mm-hmm. And some of the people I was most suspect about were actually claiming to do things, you know, on the internet in ways that I didn't know whether they were provable or not. And I actually interviewed the head of psychiatry and law at Harvard, who is a man who specializes in transgressions of the therapeutic relationship, people who try to become gurus, people who try and have power over other people, because I thought in this book it was important to warn people that, you know, not everybody is a practitioner with goodwill and a good heart, and some people are quite exploitative. And so I think it may vary broadly is what I'm trying to say. But certainly the science is there these days to suggest that we can affect other people with our minds. And I go into that in the book in quite some detail and how that works. I don't do distance healing. Everything I do is done in person. And one of the things I did for the book was I had an EKG of my heart and the EEG of my brain done while I was working. And one of the things they found out is that my heart and my brain go into the same frequency. And then the patient's heart appears to go into the same frequency as mine. And I do that in the room. Isn't that interesting? And they think that at that point, when we're all kind of emitting the same frequency from our hearts, which is so lovely because it's kind of what love is in some ways, that's when information is transferred. That's when the patient becomes receptive. And the scientists I talked to had an explanation for that. It sounds very woo, but apparently patients have a tendency to mimic through something that are called mirror neurons. So they have a tendency to, if you're a very calm practitioner, they have a tendency to then become calm themselves in response to that through what's called mirror neurons, and they become more receptive. And so that was something I didn't know. I knew I was an effective healer and I knew I was an effective acupuncturist, but until I allowed them to hook me up to machines while I was working, I had no idea that I was altering my own body and the frequencies in my body in order to do my job. But that's exactly what I was doing, which I thought was really interesting.
I mean, it, like you said, it does go back to energy. It's almost like the extreme form of bedside manner. There's, you know, you just feel comfortable around certain healers, certain practitioners, certain doctors. And it does affect how much they can affect you. It sounds like it's measurable now. If their energy is sort of egoic and arrogant or abrasive, they would not be as effective. It sounds like it's not just the knowledge we know, but the way that we go about administering the work.
Well, that was a question I asked myself, actually, Kimby. I thought, is it just that I'm nice to the patients? And I actually have a whole chapter on placebos because of that. And the truth is that placebo studies show that a warm, kind practitioner evokes a healing response in the patient, which begs the question, why wouldn't we all be warm and kind and loving to our patients? And interestingly, there's now placebo research that shows that even if you tell someone they're taking a placebo, they still feel better. They don't even have to be deceived to feel better. But the research we did for this book showed that it wasn't just warmth and kindness as an affect. There was an energetic activity that went along with that warmth and kindness that affected the frequency of the patient's heart in a way that was measurable. And we thought that that was quite significant. So I think some of it is placebo, not in a bad way, in a good way. You know, the placebo effect should be used. It does help people heal themselves. People do heal themselves in response to a variety of prompts, including placebo. But there was some kind of energetic prompt going on between me and the patient that we could measure that we thought was quite significant and was one of the things that I really enjoyed researching in this book.
Jill, another topic you talk about wearing many hats is about libido and naturally becoming, re-energizing our sexual energy. Can you tell us a little bit about your perspective of that and, you know, balancing it, why it may drop, how we can bring it up through natural means? One of our favorite topics.
I'm actually very interested in the energetics of sex. Sex Again is my book. It was my second book. My first book was called Making Babies, and it was about infertility. And my second book was called Sex Again, because a lot of my fertility patients, having tried so hard to have a baby, would tell me, "Oh, I'm never having sex again." And I would be like, no, we must rekindle your libido. And so I talk to a lot of women about why their sex drive drops. And they tell me several things. One, they tell me they're too stressed to have sex. And I think to enjoy sex, particularly as a woman, female orgasm is an elusive thing, as you know. We have to have our head in the game. And if we're making our to-do list and we're worried about tomorrow and things like that, it's hard to keep our head in the game. It's hard to stay mindful. And so actually, there is research that mindfulness practices help women have an orgasm more easily, which you can imagine if you learn not to be distracted. So that was the first thing, is that you can't let your stress make you distracted, because that makes it really hard to settle down and enjoy sex. And if you don't enjoy sex, why would you want to keep having sex?
Sure.
The other thing that women tell me a lot is that they're too self-conscious to enjoy sex. They're worried about the jiggly bit under their arm, or, you know, they're
the jiggly bits. I love that term. Yeah.
And actually, when I talk to men don't notice at that point. They're not looking for your jiggly bit, and they don't care that much. But we live in a culture where we're bombarded with sort of images that are very unrealistic in some ways, and it makes us very self-conscious. And again, female orgasm is all about letting go, and it's very hard to let go if you're being very performative. And I think we're taught, you know, we know that men are visual, so straight women often become a little performative because we know that turns them on. But there's a point when we need to let go and let go of our self-consciousness in order to really enjoy sex and in order to orgasm, in fact. So I often advise people that's a goal, is letting go of yourself. And in fact, I often talk about to my patients about the spiritual aspects of sex, and that sex is one of those few ways that we experience oneness with another human being. We kind of subconsciously know that we're all one at some level, but we don't really experience it very much except during sex. And it may be, you know, one of our experiences of God in some ways. And in order to experience that oneness and that merging, we have to let go of ourselves a little bit. And so letting go of our self-consciousness is the first step to that. And of course, porn and magazines and very sexualized images don't help us when it comes to letting go of our self-consciousness. And so that is one of the things that women tell me. And the last thing that women tell me, Kimberly, is that they're too tired to have sex. And I think we talked about wearing many hats. But our lives are exhausting. And by the time you put the kids to bed and, you know, you've done a day at work and you've caught up with your email and all of that, I mean, and women tell me the whole time that they're too exhausted. And one of the things that I suggest to people is that it doesn't always have to be a marathon. Sometimes it can be a quickie. But keeping your sexual connection going in your relationship is actually really important. Energetically, it connects you to your partner in ways that are quite mysterious, actually. And, you know, women tell me the whole time, you know, we had a quickie, And I did feel more connected to him or her all day. And I think that's an important thing to remember. So that's my usual advice. Work out if you're too stressed, too self-conscious, or too tired, and start troubleshooting from there.
Wow. Well, I'm so glad you're talking about this, Jill, because there's always, you know, aphrodisiacs and certain foods. But even if we eat those foods, like you said, if we're in our head, like, oh my God, my stomach looks bloated, or I, from this angle, maybe I look like I have a double chin, then we're never going to have an orgasm.
So no, we're too busy, we're too distracted. This is the female orgasm is a bit elusive, as you know. Men have a much easier time of that, and so we need to let go a little bit. And letting go means letting go of our judgments on ourselves and on our partners, actually, and using sex as a way of deeply connecting emotionally, physically, spiritually, and energetically. And that's what I tried to teach people in that book, Sex Again.
Mm. Well, you know, you mentioned like porn and these magazines, Jill, and I read this article once where recently, actually, for the first time in decades, women are saying that they're not as sexually satisfied because men are watching so much porn now that they're not as sexual with their partner. Have you heard this? Like, it's like this.
Yeah.
It's sad.
I think people are using porn as a substitute for sex. And
yes.
I would say that you're missing out on the important
connection.
Part of sex, which is that deep, deep connection with another human being. And you can't do that through a screen. So you can titillate yourself through a screen. You can do all sorts of things. But you don't get anything back. The porn star doesn't love you back. I think sex is an exchange of energy. It's not just an output of energy. So getting something back is part of it. So if you do have a partner, it seems a shame not to connect with them in that way and to just be in front of a screen having soulless physical experiences that don't really reach you emotionally or energetically in any significant way.
Yes, 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 exactly. It's like processed food. It's empty. So now we're talking
about
all...
I mean, that's it. I was going to say that that's how the Chinese see processed food, as energetically empty, incidentally. Mm. But an ear of corn takes energy from the sun. But by the time it's been extruded into a cornflake, the energy it took from the sun is no longer available to you. And that would be the argument for having whole foods rather than processed foods, that they're still alive in some way, that they have cheese.
I love that. I've never heard it put quite that way, Jill. That's so beautiful. So now, you know, we're going to link to all your books, which, by the way, I cannot wait to read all three, just knowing you and talking to you. So if you don't mind giving us the quick, like 1 minute version for your Maximum Fertility book, it's called Making Babies, a Proven 3-Month Program for Maximum Fertility. You know, you talk about stress, being tired, being self-conscious for sex. What are some of the energetics that someone may unknowingly block themselves from, you know, being easily fertile, shall we say?
Oh, well, that's actually very interesting. So, it's a very interesting question, Kimberly, that, because I think in order to be fertile, you do have to be a bit receptive. You have to be a receptive nest in some ways. And so the Making Babies program, what I did was I split people into 5 main types. I at the Unova Center, we see an enormous amount of fertility patients. It's one of the main things we're known for. We treat women and children, and we treat men too. We treat families, but we women's reproductive medicine is one of our real specialties here in New York. So I have a lot of experience in this area, and I realized that fertility patients really split up into 5 different types. And then I suggested a different program for each type. And that program was partly food-based, partly lifestyle-based, and partly about stress management and things like that. So the advice I give fertility patients in general is eat whole food. Eat a broad diet with lots and lots of colorful fruits and veggies, basically. People who are missing food groups tend to do worse. So people who are on a very low-fat diet, you do need some fat to make reproductive hormones. So, you know, healthy fats, you do need some carbohydrates. So, you know, some healthy grains are a great idea. Some conditions like polycystic ovarian syndrome do better on a low carb diet. We cover that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Stress management is a huge issue, in my opinion. We're evolutionarily programmed to have less babies during times of war and famine. And unfortunately, we fake that pretty well in our modern society, as you can imagine. So telling your body we're not at war is important.
Oh my gosh.
And sometimes when I'm looking at a basal body temperature chart, you know, which is the chart that women take to measure their basal body temperature every day, to measure their hormone fluctuations, I can literally see where the stressor was and how their body waited to ovulate until a little bit later. So that's important. And then doing a BBT chart, Kimberly, is a great idea. Understanding your body's rhythm really, really smart. And so at the Unova Center, we try and empower our patients to really get in touch with their rhythms and understand when they're ovulating and get their timing really right. A lot of people don't necessarily know when they're ovulating, and so they have sex around the middle of their cycle. But, you know, if you do a basal body temperature chart, you begin to really understand when your body is at its peak fertility every month. And I explain that in quite some detail in the book. Mm-hmm. And then I tell people, if you really are troubleshooting your fertility, it is worth following the program for your fertility type. You can take a quiz at unovas.com for your fertility type and work out what your fertility type is. You don't even have to buy the book. You can do the quiz online. And then we make suggestions based on these different fertility types. And the book is very effective. It's been in hardback since 2009, and I'm told that's very unusual, and it's because it still sells as well today as it always did, because it works. And if you go to Amazon, you'll see hundreds of people have said, I did what they said in the book, and I got pregnant. So it's a book I'm actually very proud of, making babies.
Oh, we'll be sure to link to it in the show notes, beauties. I mean, it sounds like such a wonderful resource, Jill. And I love what you say too about times of famine and war, because how many people I've met, and I'm sure you have too, where they just freak out, then they can't get pregnant, and then they go to adopt. They go down this whole adoption pathway, and sometimes they actually adopt the child or they're in the middle, and then they get pregnant because they're not stressed anymore. I've seen that so many times.
It does happen. And we also see people do IVF who don't need to do IVF, you know?
You're right.
I mean, some people do need to do IVF, and it's an amazing technology if you do. It's probably worth your listeners knowing that acupuncture, it would appear, increases the efficacy of IVF quite a lot. So it's worth combining acupuncture with IVF. But we also see people who do IVF very unnecessarily. And really, all they needed to do was troubleshoot their cycle a little bit. So, for instance, sometimes people are having a diet that's too acidic, and it makes their vaginal fluids, their cervical mucus, too acidic. And that just becomes inhibitory to sperm. And literally changing your diet to a more plant-based, more alkaline diet would have done the trick. And IVF works too, because it bypasses the vaginal canal and they put the embryo straight into the uterus, but it's extremely expensive and invasive. So if really just eating more veggies would have done the trick too, but it's a shame not to have done that. And that's the kind of information we give you in Making Babies, which I wrote it with a doctor. That's why I'm saying I wrote it with a reproductive endocrinologist. So you get both perspectives. You get a fertility doctor's perspective and a fertility acupuncturist's perspective in that book. And that was one of the advices we gave you, was to make sure you're hydrated so that you can have good cervical mucus, and make sure that you're having plenty of plants so that you're somewhat alkaline, because that's the most, that makes your cervical mucus as fertile as possible.
Wow. Well, you know, it makes sense. There's so many people that started drinking the Glowing Green smoothie, which is this smoothie we talk about. And, you know, we have lots of soups. I know you're a big soup fan, Jill, and, you know, cooked food, but also some smoothies. And they're like, oh, and then I got pregnant. And I just think having all those greens and like upping the vegetable content helps. And then to your point about the cervical mucus pH, that's a really interesting point about it. You know, back to your acupuncture work, because I'm so interested in it, Jill. And I actually had acupuncture when I I got it because my son was almost 2 weeks late and he was getting really big. And then they were like, oh, do some acupuncture to help speed up the, you know, the labor coming. But if we're just a general healthy person such as myself, do you think it's worth going in sometimes just to get a tune up? Or must we have some sort of medical condition to go to an acupuncturist?
Well, I love that you used acupuncture in obstetrics because that's one of our other specialties at Unova. We treat pregnant women and postpartum. And you're right, we can do a lot of labor preparation. We get people nice and loose so yes. they have easier labors. And we turn breech babies, or we help create space for breech babies to turn, would be a more accurate way of saying it. There are some really cool things that Chinese medicine has been able to do for hundreds of years for pregnant women. But yes, I tell my patients that if they're well, I'd like to see them 4 times a year. I don't need to see them every week, but I like to catch things before they slide out. So, you know, as you know, we have a very specific system of diagnosis. We look at the tongue, we take the pulse, we ask lots of interesting questions. Some of them seem weird, like, you know, are you craving hot drinks and things like that? We're getting a picture of people's pattern and landscape. And we can often from that see areas that are just sliding out a bit and correct imbalances before they become extreme. Preventative medicine in that way is one of Chinese medicine's major benefits. So I like to suggest that people come in every quarter at least. And if you can afford it, once a month is lovely.
But Jill, if I was in New York, I would definitely come see you once a month. And thank you so much for all this amazing information. For all of us beauties that are not in New York, we can still read your books. And like you said, we can take your quizzes online at unovacenter.com. So thank you so much, Jill. I could talk to you all day. I feel like when your book comes out, we should do another podcast about some of the other stuff you learned about energy healing and different plants. And I think that'll be really interesting too.
I would love to come back, Kimberly, when the book comes out and we can talk a little bit deeper about energy healing. But thank you so much for having me on your show. I love you, as you know, and it's just lovely to connect in this way. We hit off so well when we met at the Well and Good event. Oh. I'm thrilled to be able to chat to you about everything that's going on. And you're right, your listeners can go to unovacenter.com. We have a very lively blog over there, so there's lots of articles about all the things we've been talking about.
Perfect. And remember, beauties, to check out some of Jill's books, especially Sex Again, Recharging Your Libido. Sounds very interesting. So thank you so much, Jill. We look forward to having you back on, sending you so much love, and we will talk soon.
Thanks, Kimberly. Take care.
Take care. All right, beauties, you heard it here. I hope you really enjoyed our podcast today with Jill Blakeway. Remember to check out the show notes for all her links and books. And we will see you back here on Thursday for our Q&A podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Remember that we have daily inspiration for you on our website, mysaluna.com, recipes, articles, vlogs, all kinds of offerings. We also have our Instagram channel, which is @_KimberlySnyder for daily inspiration. And just a little shout out again, if you haven't yet left us a review on iTunes, please just take a moment or so to do so. And we appreciate it so much. Thank you in advance. So take great care of yourself, beauty, and we will see you back here in just a few days. Lots of love.